Okay, I have 9 o'clock, so we'll start. Today we're going to spend just a few more minutes on Rav Chaim Hirschenson, finish him up, and then we're going to move on to a new figure, Rav Yitzchak Nissim. But let me just make a few brief comments before we begin. I was looking over Shabbos again at the Malki Bakodesh, the new edition, and because someone had asked me a question about issues of monarchy and the like, and it's quite interesting. In his discussion about the Messianic era, he does state that there will be a king. But listen to how he describes it. First, he begins by saying that until we get to a Messianic era, democracy is the absolute best system. But he describes how in the Messianic era, the king will only be one whose job it is to guide the people and influence them spiritually, and everyone will accept his machuto beruchniot, that they will accept him spiritually. His vision of a Messianic era leader is a spiritual leader, maybe like the Lubavitcher Rebbe or something like that, but not an actual political leader. And he says we will not even need a democracy. Remember, he says democracy is the best form of government, because he says that all that is good that we need will exist b'teva ha'noshit ha'mutukana, that is, naturally people will do the good and do the right, and they will desire da'at u'tfuna. So what's the purpose of government? The purpose of government is to create law and order, and all these sorts of things, but he makes it seem as if, in his mind at least, we really won't need any form of government like that. I don't know. I mean, this is certainly not a Maimonidean perspective, and how are you going to decide how much money to allocate to build the roads and things like that? You still will need to do that, presumably. But he does speak of a spiritual type of figure. Now, along those lines, one of you asked me, who else holds this view of the Abarbanel? So let me just give you that monarchy is not really the form of government that we should strive for. Let me just give you one example, Rav Sadia Gaon. He comments on the verse, Som Tatsim, you shall place a king upon you. Mutar lecha hamid melech. If you want to, it's an option. And Ibn Ezra, also, on the verse that you shall place a king upon you, Rishut, he says it's a permission, so there's no obligation or anything like that. I also found something interesting in Rav Kook, in one of the new things that he came out with, the Kvatzim, Miktav Yad Kodesho. He picks up on this idea that there's a verse in Ezekiel that speaks of David, my servant, Nasi Lahem Olam, will be prince forever. And he develops the idea that there's a king and there's a prince. And that La'atid Lavo, in the future time, it'll be a Nasi, not a king. And what that means is that he says that there is you can have a king that has an expansive rule, I guess more of like a totalitarian type of king, and then there's a much smaller, localized rule. And he says that when the nation is Yoter Tov Musari, when the nation is more ethically advanced, then the role of this king or prince is much smaller. I don't know if he goes as far as Chaim Hirschenson to totally remove it from any political realm, but that's quite interesting. Two more things before we start. I mentioned the Columbia University Beit Midrash last class, and I was there on Wednesday because I teach on Wednesdays on the sixth floor of Columbia Hillel Building in Shira Chol Torah. So on the fourth floor, they have a very nice base medrash. But like I said last time, this is private. This is the Hillel, unlike at Brandeis, in which it's in university building, paid for with university money, and I don't know other than YU any other university in the country that has that. But there was a big sign on the door about a class that was taking place, I believe it was last Thursday night, the day after I was there, Rabbi Miles Brody, he's from Yeshivat HaKotel, speaking on Rav Chaim Hirschenson, he's giving a shiur on Rav Chaim Hirschenson and Rav Kook's view about sacrifices in the future era. So we had just spoken about that a couple days before, and he's speaking on it also. For those who don't know, Miles Brody, also known as Shlomo Brody, he's the one, if you read the Jerusalem Post once a week or so, he has a column there, a very interesting column, answering questions about where practices came from, things like that. He also finished up at Harvard a few years ago, and he wrote a senior thesis on Ritzvi Hirschchayes. I'm sure he'd be happy to send it to anyone. He's the son of Baruch Brody. Baruch Brody is a leading Jewish ethicist, is a regular ethicist and a Jewish ethicist from Houston. I actually stayed in his house for Shavuos a few years ago. He was chosen to be president of Yeshiva University and turned it down. This is before they came to Richard Joel. They asked Brody. He turned it down. They asked Zakheim. Zakheim accepted it. And then you had all these protests and everything, and he said, what do I need this aggravation for? And then they went to Joel. Had they gone to Joel first, there would have been all the protests for Joel, and then they could have gone to Zakheim. The people who were protesting didn't want someone who was not a rabbinic figure, even though Zakheim, incidentally, does have smicha. And finally, I just want to call your attention to one other interesting thing. I had kind of emails offline, or on, I don't know what you call it, online, with someone about Ritzi Yehuda Cook and Balei Tshuva. So let me just tell you, because I think a lot of you might find this interesting. We dealt with Ritzi Yehuda, that's why it's relevant. A couple classes ago, in the last semester, I mentioned Rashach's opinion, who he really is against this whole Kirov business as a goal. What it became, that this is something to strive for, and it becomes, people, that's what, not people that drop out of yeshiva have to do this, but this becomes the goal. And we saw that for Rav Shach, the only goal was to become a good old Torah. And if you can't for some reason, okay, so you can do Kirov, but that can't be in and of itself. Rav Tzvi Yehuda has a different perspective on it also, with a very strong criticism of what's known as Kirov, which I think is probably applicable to many of the people out in Kirov, but certainly not to Chabad. Let me just give you background for a minute. It seems often that the people involved in Kirov, the be-all and end-all, is to make people religious. And because it's become like a business, it creates all sorts of other problems. I recall once sitting at a table with someone who was talking about one of these people who was very involved with Kirov, and he was telling a story about one of his colleagues who for about 3 years, every Sunday, would go out fishing with this guy. And then the end of the story was when this guy finally died, he left him a nice amount of money. And that was, so the whole point of going to go fishing with the guy was to create a good relationship then to get money. Now, I understand you need to do that, but somehow it didn't seem, listening to it from the inside, it didn't seem like it was entirely lishma. But we all know that people involved in Kirov, a big effort of them, that's the be-all and end-all, to make people religious. They speak about this. Ritzi Yehuda Cook commented as follows. It says in Pirkei Avos, and I think it's a very important insight, it says in Pirkei Avos that you should be like the students of Aaron, Ohe v'tabriot u'makarvon l'Torah, to love people and to bring them close to Torah. It doesn't say, Ohe v'tabriot k'dei l'karvon l'Torah. You should love these people, the non-religious, in order to bring them close to Torah. These are two separate things. You should love them, and you should bring them close to Torah. Now, I have no doubt that Chabad does that, and they take people as an individual, but for many of the other Kirov people, I wonder sometimes if they knew for certain that this person has no interest in becoming religious, don't they seem to drop him, and really it's not worth their efforts? At least that's been the sense I get. And it's a nice insight from Tzvi Yehuda. That's quite apart from other issues of Kirov, which we don't have time to discuss, but someone I respect a great deal wrote something recently, maybe at the end of the class we can discuss it further, in that we now have many, many people who've left Orthodoxy, young people, and I'm not talking about drug addicts or anything, just normal people, and it doesn't work for them for a variety of reasons, and really it doesn't seem like there's any rabbis or anyone out there willing to listen to them, and all this money we have, we put all this money into and efforts into bringing people in from the outside, being makariv them, and what about the people in our own community who are losing? Not to mention the enormous amounts of money that are spent on Kirov, and yet we have people today, I know people myself, who cannot afford to send their kids to day school, and next year it's going to be even worse. So I can send you a link, if anyone's interested, to what he wrote, that he's questioning whether all this efforts reaching out is really proper. Now we maybe it's time to reach in. There's the economic circumstance, but also that we are losing our own people. And that no one has created organizations to deal with the people in our own community. There is one in Lakewood, incidentally, Rav Avadi's son, but it's an interesting thing. Yes, it's going to become much worse with the tuition crisis, and but even without the tuition crisis, the dropouts and everything, especially. So these are things we can deal with maybe later. But now I want to conclude with Rav Chaim Hirschenson with one final issue, and that's biblical criticism. Why is Rav Chaim Hirschenson dealing with biblical criticism? Well, the Hebrew University was established, and there was a big problem. What were they going to teach there when it comes to Bible? The Orthodox were very opposed to biblical criticism. Rav W. C. Hoffman, I published in English translation some material from Rav W. C. Hoffman. He was asked, is it even permissible for Orthodox Jews to be involved with the university? And there's been a lot written on this. David Myers, in one of his books, details the disputes that went on behind the scenes about that, with the conclusion that although it was never brought to fruition, they originally came to agreement that there would be two chairs in Bible, one of more traditional variety and one who practiced academics, higher criticism. Rav Chaim Hirschenson, understanding the significance of the university, wants to determine, well, what is the issue of biblical criticism? And it's the only example of halachic responsum that I know of dealing with the problem of biblical criticism. And he begins first by explaining there's two types of biblical criticism. There's higher criticism and lower criticism. Higher criticism deals with documents. That is, you divide, you say this part comes from this era, this author, this comes from another era, J-E-P-A-D, etc. And then there's lower criticism. Lower criticism looks at words. Is there a mistake in our biblical text? Perhaps the Septuagint preserves the proper text. Perhaps the Targumim preserve the proper text. So we have Rashis that preserve different texts. He shows that lower criticism is absolutely permissible, and not only is it permissible, it even is included in the mitzvah of study of Talmud Torah. True, we do not change our Torah scrolls. We already made our decisions. The Masoretes and the Poskim determined what our Torah scrolls should be, so we don't change them in shul. However, simply for the sake of study, there is nothing wrong with arguing that and I did this in my book on the 13 principles. I gave some examples that our Torah scrolls, the ones we read in shul every Shabbos, preserve a faulty reading. We're not going to change it, but we should know it's a faulty reading, and that's considered part of Torah study. And analyzing this, the Yemenites have a couple different readings than ours. So that's the first aspect. For those who are Talmudists and Torah scholars, this isn't at all surprising. There's Talmudic passages in the Talmud where Tosfos comments that we have a different version in our Talmud. That's lower criticism. Then he moves on to higher criticism. And here is quite an interesting position, which I don't think is historically accurate, but it's interesting nonetheless. He says that the problem with higher criticism is, in which you're asserting that different authors over time, is that you are casting aspersions on Moshe. You're asserting that he forged the Torah without it, you know, you're making him a liar. You're saying that traditionally the opposition to denial of Mosaic authorship was that Moses claimed to be the author. You're turning him into a liar. And he says that's the ultimate heresy, to consider Moses a liar. And he derives this from a tractate Sanhedrin 99a, which says, it quotes the verse in the book of Numbers, because he has despised the word of the Lord. This refers to one who says there is no Torah from heaven. And even if he says the whole of the Torah is from heaven, excepting a particular verse, which he says was not said by the Holy One, blessed be he, but by Moses on his own accord, he is included in this heresy. So the stress is on claiming that Moses, although Moses said it, but he really didn't, he really didn't write it, someone else wrote it, and Moses takes credit, or Moses did not hear it from the Holy One, you're turning Moses into a liar. That's what he says the Talmud was concerned with. I'm very skeptical of that, but he then points out that contemporary biblical criticism really has nothing to do with this, because contemporary Bible critics
don't say that Moses wrote it on its own and attributed it to God, or there was other texts that Moses took credit for. No, on the contrary. Contemporary Bible critics tell you that this was written many, many years after Moses. So since the issue, which the Talmud is concerned with, is, according to Hirschenson, slandering Moses, saying that he wrote something on his own accord, when in reality we're supposed to believe that it came through him prophetically, this is totally irrelevant to modern biblical criticism. Rav Chaim Hirschenson divides the study of biblical criticism into three categories. Mutar, which he says is permitted, which is lower criticism. Chayav, that is, you're regarded as a heretic, you no chelak in Olam Haba. That's if you assert that Moses is a fraud. And then asur, something which is wrong, which is mistaken, which we need to correct people, but you are not in this category of denying Jewish dogma. You're not out. You haven't lost your share in the world to come. And that is all contemporary biblical criticism. So this is a very unique and really radical movement to try to keep all modern biblical scholarship, etc., asur, forbidden, not the traditional approach, but not regard them as violating of any dogmas, not outside the fold, etc. Again, I see that I'm very skeptical because I don't think the Talmud's concern really, or at least I don't think its major concern was the slandering of Moses. I think the important thing is the idea that it was a unitary document, that but you never know. Maybe that was one of the concerns. Certainly that's what Hirschenson says. Yes, Kasuto did oppose the documentary theory, and he's often quoted by people like Nachama Leibowitz and the like, but Kasuto and M.H. Siegel and others did not. M.H. Siegel wrote the book The Pentateuch, its authorship. He wrote also the Hebrew, a grammar of Mishnaic Hebrew, a great, great biblical scholar. But none of these people shared the traditional approach. Kasuto surely didn't share the traditional approach. They just denied the idea of four documents, etc. But you're right, Kasuto, he's very important and influential. So, really, this is Hirschenson's way of bringing, he tries to bring everyone into the fold. We already saw how he brought the Shabbos violators into the fold, he brings many others, and now the people who are rejecting what traditional Judaism regarded as basis, Mosaic authorship of the Torah, they're wrong, these people who reject it, but they're still in the fold, and the Talmud does not regard them as heretical, which ties into what we said last time, that really there's no real dogmas for Hirschenson other than belief in God and his unity. So with that, I could go on for another couple classes on Rav Chaim Hirschenson, but I think it's time to bring that him to an end. If anyone has any final questions about this most fascinating figure, who his significance is now growing, he's becoming more influential. If not, we will go on, or you can hold it to the end of the class. Okay. Well, then let us move on to deal with Rav Yitzchak Nissim. Here is a picture of him from sometime in the 1950s. This is a biography. It's called Min HaHar El Ha'am, written really by his son, who I'll speak about later, Meir Ben Ayahu. Here's another picture of him in his regalia as a Sephardic chief rabbi. We now turn towards Baghdad, because that's where Rav Yitzchak Nissim comes from. He has been very much overshadowed by Rav Avadi Yosef, and we'll see their own conflict. They really had a real, they were fighting over the loyalty of the Baghdadi community, and Rav Avadi Yosef emerges victorious in many ways. So he's been overshadowed, Rav Nissim, and we'll come back to his difficult relationship with Rav Avadia. But Rav Nissim was himself very significant in his time. In fact, for a number of years, he was the only chief rabbi of the State of Israel, as we'll see. So we have to deal with him. And he really falls into the category of a modern Orthodox or religious Zionist figure. As always, let us start with the biography, which I think will be more unusual or not as well known. For many of you, we're so used to the Lithuanian yeshiva world, Jewish life in Poland. There's a whole other world, not just one world. There are worlds out there, so we need to look at that. He's born in 1895 in Baghdad. The Iraqi Jewish community is an ancient community. there is basically nothing left of it. Every now and then you'll see an article in one of the papers about the few Jews left in Iraq. Just like I remember in Afghanistan, apparently there's two Jews who don't, old Jews don't speak to one another. The New York Times tracked down these two old Jews a couple of years ago. But this was an ancient community. Let us remember, Iraq is the land of the Gaonim. It's the land of the Babylonian Talmud. Jews, until the decades after the State of Israel was proclaimed, when there was a massive immigration, Jews had been living there since 586 BCE, since the destruction of the Second Temple. It is also the land, of course, of Mesopotamia. So our history, the history of Abraham and the like, we really trace ourselves to Iraq. I think it's correct to say that there was a longer, continuous settlement of Jews in Iraq than anywhere else in the world. Where else do you have continuous settlement from 586 BCE? I don't know of anywhere else. There were always Jews in the land of Israel. That's true. You've had Jews in the land of Israel from the days Joshua entered it. However, at many times, we're talking about tiny amounts, in the tens. You can even read the Ramban's description when he comes to the land of Israel. There were times you might not have had... you might have had 10 Jews in Jerusalem, if that. You might not have had more than 200 Jews in the entire land of Israel in the Crusader times, etc. So when I speak about continuous community, I'm speaking about a real community. We know that when Rav Nissim was a young boy, he was different than other young people. And you've heard the story over and over again. In fact, I don't think there's one example of a great sage, a gadol, who was like all the other kids. Because if he was, he wouldn't have turned into who he was. Just like I don't think any piano prodigy or anything like that, they were like normal kids because they're busy playing the piano or studying Torah. But we know that he loved books and began collecting them early on. Now, I don't know. I mean, when you have six-year-olds, seven-year-olds, eight-year-olds who are so focused on the books, we like to get them outside to play sports, to become, you know, more normal, to have the rest of their life to focus on the books. But not Rav Nissim. And this was the beginning of his great library, which became one of the nicest private libraries in the world. It doesn't compare to the library of Jack Lunzer, currently on sale. I don't know if anyone has in the New York area saw it at Sotheby's last week, but it certainly was a very wide-ranging and extensive library and many manuscripts. You can see the library today. It's been kept together at a place called Yad HaRav Nissim in Jerusalem. I'll get back to that. In Baghdad, he studied at a place called Beit Zilcha. This was a yeshiva established in the 19th century by a great Iraqi sage called Rav Abdallah Somech, and all the great Iraqi scholars studied there. In 1896, Rav Nissim's family goes on Aliyah. Now, from an economic standpoint, Jerusalem was a very difficult place to live. It was very difficult to make a living there. And there were other problems as well. The different communities fought with each other. They had nothing in common. You had the Ashkenazi, you had the Hungarians, and the Lithuanians, and they didn't get along. And in the Sephardic world, you had similar things. In fact, the Jews could not even speak to one another. You had the Arabic-speaking Jews, you had Ladino-speaking Jews, you had the Yiddish Jews. It was a very difficult life. So he was only in Jerusalem for a few years, and then his family sends him back to Baghdad, which was more conducive for his studies, and I don't need to go through the stories of what a great scholar he was when he was young. Sometimes I get the sense that you would take these stories, and you, it really doesn't matter. You can just replace different great figures, and you get the same sort of stories. Suffice it to say that when he was already quite young, he was recognized as a genius. Now, what's unique, though, about his family and how he was being trained is that whereas in Europe, someone like this would be immediately put on the so-called rabbinic track, yeshiva, to then get married but to a wealthy girl, that is, with a wealthy father-in-law, and learn all day and then become a rabbi or something like that. That was not Rav Nissim's family. He comes from a family of great Torah scholars. But they all believed, and they were part of this tradition, I guess you would call it a Maimonidean tradition, that Torah scholars have to work for a living. No becoming rabbis and being supported by the community. We already saw that in Yemen. We dealt with this with Rav Kafach's family. The concept of being supported by the community was unheard of in Yemen. In Baghdad, you had rabbis supported by the community, but in Rav Nissim's family, that was a no-no. you worked for a living. I mean, there were a few who were supported. If I'm not mistaken, the Beni Shai, I was supported. I'm not certain about that. But most Torah scholars in Iraq worked for a living. And what did they work on? Well, they're in business. Business was a big thing. And Rav Nissim's family, this goes back to his father, they were merchants. They imported things to Baghdad. Now, it became quite easy to import when Iraq came under the control of England after World War I, or the influence, I don't know if it's the official control, because you could then import cheaply from both England and from India. There was even a nice Iraqi Jewish community in India, as we'll see. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, Iraq after World War I was actually a mandate, just like Palestine, so it was very easy. We know that Rav Nissim traveled all over Iraq, very involved in his business ventures. Only at night did he have time to study. He spent a lot of time in Basra, which of course is in the news often. It's British territory now, as the British soldiers are in charge of Basra. I don't believe there's any Jews left in Basra, although, as I said, there's a few in Baghdad. But there was a nice Jewish community then. Now, if this idea of a Talmud Chacham, like Rav Nissim, working for a living, is something it's hard to imagine today for many people. The idea of a great Torah scholar working for a living. There was a time when people could not imagine a great Torah scholar working at any profession other than a Rav, that is, a Rav supported by the community. Today, I think that people can't even imagine a great Torah scholar as the Rav of a community. Today, to be a great Torah scholar, by which I mean, Major League, Gadol B'Yisrael, the sense out there is that you have to be a Rosh Yeshiva, or you have to be someone supported by the community as a posek of sorts. But the idea that someone will be a great posek, a Gadol B'Yisrael, and actually serve as a rabbi of a community, we don't have that anymore. That sort of died out beginning in the 1960s in America. In Europe, all the great poskim were rabbanim. And we spoke in previous classes how the trend away. So today, these Rosh Yeshiva and the like, they don't even think that pulpit rabbis, many of them are contemptuous of the local rabbis, and their attitude is, you can perform weddings and funerals, but if there's any real problems, you come to us. How things would be different if the rabbi still had significance. Since he was working, though, Rav Nissim was also able to buy books. And as I said, he started this practice when he was young, and he was able to build up a very big collection. Now, Ashkenazim generally were not interested in the Sephardic books. The typical Ashkenazi in Eastern Europe or in Central Europe did not read the Sfarim of the Sephardic rabbis, had no interest whatsoever, and that was also the case for the typical Sephardic rabbi. There were certain books that were canonical, the Note of Yehuda, the Chatam Sofer, but for the most part, they did not read them. And when we deal with Rav Mesas next class, we'll see they have their own canon, their own tradition. And the same thing for the Iraqis. They have their own important holy books and Sfarim. But Rav Nissim was not like that. He bought, and he wrote to Europe, had them send him all the books of the Ashkenazic authorities. He's very unique in that. In fact, in the introduction to his book of responsa, the Yain HaTov, we'll speak about in a few minutes, you have here letters from Ashkenazic sages. One from Rav Chaim Yeruchim, who's the Rav in Alstadt. He was mentioned on a blog, the learned author of the blog, Ishi Meshitos. He cited someone, the Rav of Alstadt. He wanted to know who the Rav of Alstadt is. And here, the Rav of Alstadt is Rav Chaim Yitzchak Yeruchim. A great name in his day, today totally forgotten. But more interesting is, you can see it there, maybe you can't see it, Michtav Me'agon Balcha Mitzchayim of Mishneh Brura. Rav Nissim in Baghdad was corresponding with the Chafetz Chaim. So that, I think, is quite interesting. I don't know of any other Sephardic authorities who had any relationship with him. And in fact, we learned something interesting from the Chafetz Chaim's letter to him. This was in 1924. He might have already been in Jerusalem in 1924. I don't remember. Rav Nissim asked him, you know, here you wrote this great book, the Mishneh Berurah. How about writing a Mishneh Berurah on Yoredeah? Would have been very nice, very interesting. And the Chafetz Chaim answers him that he says he can't because he's focused too much on writing his book on his Torah Kohanim. He's writing, he has a commentary there on the Sifra. Is it in here? Let me find it. He's already, he says, I reached a Gevurot, I'm 80 years old. I think it's actually another letter where he says to him that he's busy writing his commentary on another work. And then he says to him, yeah, here it is, Rav Taras Kohen, he wrote a commentary on the Rach Midrash, the Sifra. And he says, Rav Nissim wanted him to give Haskama to some of his writings, and the Chavetz Chaim is also quite interesting. He says, I looked at what you wrote, and I see you're a great Torah scholar, but I can't give you an approbation, and I don't give approbations anymore, because if I start giving any approbations, there will not remain for me time, if I start giving approbations, I will not even have time to do simple davening, because thousands of letters will be coming in from every Tom, Dick, and Harry asking me to read their book and write approbations. And he says, I don't have permission to do this. That is, I have an obligation to write my svarim, and if I start writing on giving haskama to books, Yerushalayim and Kol Makamot, you know, the Chavetz, they'll come to me from all over. You have to know who the Chavetz Chaim was in his last 10 years. I think part of the reason the Mishnah Berurah is so significant is not because of the work itself, as much because we have works like the Aruch HaShulchan, which are I would think, more original. It's the Chavetz Chaim became known as a saint. And when he came to the Aguda convention, and when he went, I mean, the whole Jewish people looked up to him as a figure. There was no figure like the Chavetz Chaim. We don't have a figure like that today. So if the Chavetz Chaim is giving Haskama, everyone's going to want Haskama from him. In one of Chaim Grada's books, I forget now which one, maybe it's the Aguna, he has a scene there, and more than a scene, he has a couple chapters in which you see the significance of the Chavetz Chaim. You mean when you Chaim Lander, you say the Sichos of a son, you mean his son's biography of the Chavetz Chaim? Is that the work you're talking about? The son wrote a biography of the Chavetz Chaim, which is full of interesting stuff. One of the things he talks about, incidentally, is the contradictions in the Mishnah Berurah, back and forth. And if I'm not mistaken, he says that other people were involved in the Mishnah Berurah. That was one of the issues. And then he tells us something interesting about his mother, how his mother never davened or anything, which is also quite interesting to show the difference between the era. Okay, you'll have to send me those comments, Chaim. Very interesting. Very nice, very interesting stuff. Send me that, what sefer you're referring to. I'm not sure which one. I have in the letters of the Chavetz Chaim at the beginning, he has a nice, there's a biography, and there's another biography, it was translated into Art Scroll, a long two-volume biographies of Rav Yosher. There's obviously a lot about the Chavetz Chaim. He did replace the Magen Avraham. I think in a sense, that's why the Mishnah Berurah triumphed also. By the time you get to the 20th century, there no longer is room for any new codes. We have the code. It's the Shulchan Aruch. The only way to get your two cents in to have a contribution is to write a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The idea that you can replace the Shulchan Aruch, that's from the past. Although with the Yalkut Yosei, that apparently is becoming a new Shulchan Aruch. We might see the Shulchan Aruch replaced. But certainly in Europe, you needed to do it as a commentary. And if you know the Mishnah Berurah is not a code. It's about adding up shitas. It's about, as they say, being yotzei kol adeyot, trying to fulfill the different opinions. It's not an original work like the Aruch HaShulchan. Let's move on. Rav Nissim was also very unusual in that he had very close relationships with Ashkenazic rabbanim. At that point in time, in the 20s and 30s, it wasn't so common. We know, for example, he was very friendly with Ritzi Pesach Frank. And Ritzi Pesach Frank was someone in particular he was quite friendly with, and we'll speak more about that later on, very close to Rav Yoshev, although there is a bit of a falling out with Rav Yoshev, and with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as was Rav Vad, yes, Rav Vad, from a later period, was with Ritzi Pesach Frank, even studied in his kollel. I will quote, when we deal with Rav Vadya has a eulogy on Rosh Pesach Frank, and he, if you recall my lectures on Rav Avadia and his negative comments about the Chazon Ish's influence, he actually attributes, he uses his hesped, his eulogy on Rosh Pesach Frank to get another dig in on the Chazon Ish, you know, comparing the Chazon Ish negatively to Rosh Pesach Frank. But we'll get to that when we deal with Rosh Pesach in a few classes. Rav Nissim also had a very special relationship with the man known as Hasaba Kadisha, Rav Shlomo Alfandari, the great, great scholar, had lived in Israel for many years, died about over 100 years old, a mystic, and a, he comes from Turkey, a mystic and a posek. He was very influential, close to this, the Munkat Sharav, I'll speak on him in a minute. I just was in a Sfarim store and I saw they came out in English with a book describing the Munkatcher's relationship with him. But this Rav Shlomo Alfandari was a very unique figure in the early 20th century, dies in 1933, I believe it is. And he was an extremist, no doubt about it, a real kanai. But when the extremists began to attack Rav Kook, really attack Rav Kook, we have a letter from the Saba Kadisha to Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap stating that they should be persecuted, that the extremists should be persecuted, even monetarily. That is, that means you should take away the kohalim, should take away the money that these guys get, because although he opposed Rav Kook like Rav Zonnenfeld opposed Rav Kook, which means that there's a limit to how much you oppose Rav Kook. Rav Kook is still a Talmud Chacham, and you still have to show respect for him. But Rav Nissim was very close to the Saba Kadisha. In fact, when he died, Rav Nissim got his manuscripts and was influential in having them published. In the biography of Rav Nissim, this book here, they even tell an interesting story that when the Munkacher Rav, we will have classes on the Munkacher Rav, assuming we're still going next semester, the semester after, Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro, who himself was an incredible personality, he had this very interesting relationship just through writing with the Saba Kadisha. And he makes this trip to Israel, again, I think it's 33, I could be wrong on the year, maybe 32, and when he comes and he sees Alfandari, according to the biography, Rav Nissim was there, and the Munkacher makes a bracha. He makes the bracha Shechayanu. Now, Rav Nissim, according to the biography, points out right on the spot that this is a mistake. Munkacher Rav, Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro, you should be not making a bracha Shechayanu. Because according to the Shulchan Aruch, the only time you can make this bracha is if it's a former friend of yours, one that you've seen before, and then you haven't seen him in a long time, then you can make the bracha. But you've never seen him, so you can't make the bracha. So here, this is quite interesting. The Munkacher Rav is one of the most distinguished, elderly Hasidic Rebbes, and he wasn't just a Rebbe. He was a great posek, a gaon in learning. And here Rav Nissim is telling him that he's wrong. The story, though, is not 100% accurate, because in this book, the Tshuva, the Yain HaTov, he discusses this event, and he states explicitly that he was not there when the Saba Kadisha came. He just heard, when Rav Afandari was visited by the Munkacher, Rav Afandari couldn't leave his house, he was like 102 years old or something, but he heard about what the Munkacher Rav did, and he spread his opinion, and he wrote up a responsum justifying his opinion. The old halacha is that if you haven't seen your friend for 30 days and you didn't know how things were with him, when you saw him, you would make the blessing. However, today it's not really relevant because in the olden days, you hadn't seen him for 30 days. You hadn't heard from him either. Today, we're in communication on the telephone, on email and all that, although I guess you could have a case where you have a friend you haven't spoken to, communicated with in a few years, you could say Shachayanu. I wonder if you see this friend's, if you're in touch with someone else who's constantly keeping you up to date on what your friend is doing, I don't know whether you make a Shachayanu then, but if it's just a friend you haven't seen in a number of years and you become reacquainted, you would be able to make Shachayanu even today. So then why did the Munkacher make Shachayanu? He certainly knew the Shulchan Aruch backwards and forwards. Well, in the book Masa'ot Yerushalayim, actually now I have it written down here, which describes the 1930 visit to Israel, to Eretz Yisrael, the Munkacher. This is a big deal. You know, the Munkacher Rav, when a Rebbe goes to the land of Israel, especially in those days. In those days, to go to the land of Israel, you had to go on boats. It was a big deal. They published a whole book describing it. How he would go to this place, he'd go to the Maros Machpelah here and there. And they still do it when these big Hasidic Rebbes go. Today, of course, they go with the whole entourage, not just the four or five people like the Munkach or the Satmar Rav, when he goes to Israel, they charter a plane. And if you pay $100,000, you get to sit in the row in front of the Rebbe and in the row in back of him. He'll go with 50, 60 people. It's a big deal. Yeah. Thank you, Dov. Although I wonder today, you can make Mechaye Mesim. My feeling is, my sense is that in the olden days, you didn't know if someone was alive. And then you come to the town and you see someone you haven't seen in 5 years. Today, I have friends, for example, who I haven't seen in a couple of years and I haven't even spoken to them. But, I know who their parents are, so I know they're still alive. I know everything is well with them. I'll ask their parents. I'll say, oh, we just had another kid, that sort of thing. I don't know. I don't think in that case you could make a Mechaye Mesim. The whole point is that, it's something new. The person's alive, but my friends, they're alive for me, even though I don't see them. And obviously, yes, you can meet old friends. If you meet them on Facebook, well, if you see them, maybe you could say Shachrianu. I don't know. It's a good question. I think this maybe is the old question of can you be Yotze Havdala on a telephone, etc. But you'll have to ask your local rabbi whether you meet your old friend on Facebook if you say Shachrianu. No. Okay, so Rav Avadia Paskins, you say Shechianu, which I wasn't sure about, but I don't think Mechaye HaMesim, but you never know. So Simcha, you can ask the question about Facebook. I was in the room once when I asked Rav Soloveitchik, do you fulfill Bikur Cholim through the telephone? And he replied, no. He said that you're lacking the personal element. So you could say the same thing, if you speak to someone on the phone, maybe you still should say Shachrianu, but Facebook already, or what we do, that's somewhere between personal and telephone. It's more close than personal, more close than the telephone, obviously. So I don't know. So returning to the Munkacher, this book, Masot Yerushalayim, which was just published by one of his followers, he describes the visit, and he states that the Munkacher felt that he was entitled to make the bracha Shachrianu, and he doesn't see this as in violation of Shulchan Aruch. He sees this as really explaining the Shulchan Aruch, because it depends on how you feel. If you normally, and this is what Shulchan Aruch is speaking about, you don't feel great joy when you see someone you've never seen before. I mean, it's only when you see someone who you're old friends with, but someone who you've only been in touch with through emails or something, you don't embrace when you see them. It's not that sort of relationship. But he had this sort of what they call avas nefesh. His soul was joined with the Saba Kadisha. I don't know if Alfandari felt that way about the Munkacher, but the Munkacher looked up to Alfandari as almost like a father figure and as one of the last remaining pure Torah scholars. That is, the Agudas Torah scholars, though, they were all krum. They had all been bought off by the Zionist money. They were all willing to cooperate with the Zionists to try to secure settlements in the land of Israel. Obviously, the religious Zionist Gedolim were puzzle. So you have Hungarian rabbis. Well, he didn't like the Satmar Rav very much. And most of the Hungarian rabbis, were not the greatest Lamdanim, at least compared to the Munkacher. So you take someone like the Munkacher, who's head and shoulders above the typical Rabbanim. Who can someone like that look up to? He can't look up to Rav Chaim Ozer. He can't look up to Rav Kook. He can't look up to the great Torah scholars. And in the Hungarian world, he really is the greatest of Torah scholars. So he found this person, the Saba Kadisha, great Torah scholar, great mystic. Because obviously, if you're a Hasidic Rav, you look up to a mystic. Someone who he feels represents the old way, the traditional way, that hasn't been corrupted by Zionism. One who grew up in the mid-19th century. Can you imagine in a pure Torah society in the Sephardic world where you didn't have Haskalah? And he saw him as, like I said, a fatherly figure. So when he saw him, this was very emotional, and he felt that he can make the bracha. Yes, that's a very interesting point, Chaim. Have all this talk about the Baal Shem Tov and the Orach Chaim, and then when his brother-in-law goes to Israel, he writes back about him. That's it could be, although he doesn't mention that. There always was in the Ashkenazic world, not today, because today we live with Sephardim, the Sephardim always had this exotic element towards them. And whenever Sephardic Rabbanim came to the Ashkenazic world, it was like a really big deal, and people would wait online to see them. And they'd come into, let's say, if a Sephardic Rav would come, like the Chida would show up in Frankfurt or something. It's a real sight. When Rav Eliyahu Chazan, who was the Rav in Alexandria, comes to Krakow for this big rabbinic convention in the early 20th century, you know, when they dress the way the Sephardic Rav dresses. It's a real scene, and it's something. So you have this idea of the Sephardic Rav. It got to the point so much, the kissing up, that in the great Shemitah dispute, we all know about the Ashkenazic Rabbanim, but the Yisa'ish, or Yaakov Shal Yashar, he supported also selling the land. And the Yeshuas Malko, the Kutna Rav, he says, he has a very interesting line. He says that the Sephardic Rabbanim, that we're like nothing compared to the Sephardic Rabbanim. You know, their fingernail is worth, you know, all of us. So, which I don't think is true, but you have this idea that they would look up to the Sephardic rabbis as representing some sort of pure Judaism. And you saw some of this in the Friedlander forged Yerushalmi. This man, Friedlander, forged the Talmud, Jerusalem Talmud, the Order of Kutshim, which was lost. And he got all these people, great gedolim, to accept it as authentic. And part of the way he was able to get them to accept it was because he styled himself, although he was from a Europeaner, he styled himself as the Sephardic rabbi who had come into Europe, and he was given all this kavod as this unique figure. Of course, he was a Sephardic rabbi. It just, for some reason, didn't seem to bother all these gedolim that this Sephardic rabbi has spoke with an Ashkenazic accent, but that's a different problem. The Torah Tumimah talks about this. Yeah, and Chaim, the Torah Tumimah also, he had a vested interest in this because he claims, and I'm assuming it's true, but he claims that he is descended from Sephardim, from the Benvenisti family. I don't know if the Aruch HaShulchan ever mentions that, but so there's always this idea. Also, the Magen Avraham explains that the reason you don't make the bracha if you haven't seen him is because you don't have love for him. So he says that shows that if you do have love for him, you can make the bracha. And in his tshuvot, in the Minchas Elazar, which is, he has five volumes of tshuvot, he elaborates and explains, they quote sources that says, if you have any doubt, if you have joy, you can make the bracha. So certainly, if you don't have doubt, you can make the bracha. And this shows that there's at least according to him, there's an individual element here. That when the Shulchan Aruch is giving halacha, this has to also leave open the possibility of personal feelings. Because you can, if you have any doubt, discuss that. It's not blanket, do it or don't do it. They say, that depending on what circumstance, even if, because if you don't have joy, you shouldn't make the bracha, and if you do have joy, you do, and if you're not sure, you also do. When I read this in the Minchas Elazar, this reminded me of another psak of a great Rav. I'll just mention it because I think it's relevant to many of us listening now. We've spoken about this Rav so many times, and he has a real Toronto connection. And he also focuses on the personal feelings in dealing with the halacha of the Shulchan Aruch. And I'm referring to Rav Nachum Rabinovich. And listen to this psak. The Aruch HaShulchan, we just heard about from Chaim Landerer, about Rav Baruch Epstein, the Torah Tumimah, the great Torah Tumimah, who is the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. By the way, the Aruch HaShulchan is actually after the Mishnah Berurah. Although the Aruch HaShulchan quotes the Mishnah Berurah. And Rav Moshe Feinstein held more of the Aruch HaShulchan than the Mishnah Berurah. Yosef Yalhinkin famously speaks about how in an argument between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, we go like the Aruch HaShulchan. Although today that is not the case at all. Today they published the Aruch HaShulchan with the psukim at the bottom of the Mishnah Berurah, as we mentioned. Now, the reason they have the psukim of the Mishnah Berurah is to show you that the Aruch HaShulchan is just a safer you study, but in terms of practical halacha, you have to follow the Mishnah Berurah. There was a lot written on this on the Sfarim blog a couple of years ago. Rav Dov Leor, the Rav of Kiryat Arba, who's also a follower of the Aruch HaShulchan, was outraged by this and wrote how it's a bizayon, it's a disgrace to the Aruch HaShulchan that today you have people who feel the Aruch HaShulchan can't be published on its own. Yeah, I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration from Rav Shechter, because already I know that in the 60s people were in the Mishnah Berurah, but it wasn't, he had only died 30 or 40 years prior. He died in 33. Rav Soloveitchik would disagree with the Mishnah Berurah. Today, people won't disagree. That's why I think maybe we're in a new era, because people today are afraid to disagree with the Mishnah Berurah. So one of the famous psukim in the Mishnah Berurah, which everyone goes by, is this on Shabbos, right? That when we have tea, we have to do an akli shlishi, a third kos. The Rav, Rav Shechter quotes this in Nefesh HaRav, the Rav said, my grandfather Rav Chaim served tea in a kos, in a klisheni, in the second kos. So why do I have to listen to the Mishnah Berurah? That's what I'll do. Today it's very different. Today the Mishnah Berurah, and Chaim Soloveitchik in his article, Rupture and Reconstruction, discusses some of that as well. Yeah, you know, late 60s, you already have people weren't in the Mishnah Berurah, but it wasn't the work it is today. Rav Meshulam Roth, we're coming up to Purim, so let me just mention that since you say it, these things just pop in my head, but we're all going to, on Parshas Zachar, we're all going to repeat the verse there. It says, Zecher Amalek, remember the memory of Amalek. And then there's another way of reading it, Zecher Amalek. And you should know, there's no question, really. It's Zecher Amalek. That's all the traditions. This is a relatively recent thing. 19th century is really the first time we see people advocating to read both Zecher and Zecher. And in fact, when I was young, they read it, Timcha es Zecher Amalek. Timcha es Zecher Amalek. And it's been maybe 10 years since I've seen that. Today, they all read the whole Pasuk over from the beginning. The Mishnah Berurah writes that you should read it twice. There's a question how the Vilna Gaon read it, but we don't have time to get into that now. It's because the Mishnah Berurah states that, that's how it became so popular. So from Meshulam Roth, who was a great posek, writing in the 1950s, he can say, no, we don't accept this. But the Mishnah Berurah's popularity is seen in the fact that today everyone repeats it. This wasn't the practice in many places, but now I think it's the universal Ashkenazic practice to repeat it, and that's directly due to the influence of the Mishnah Berurah. Another area where the Mishnah Berurah hasn't been so influential, but in yeshiva worlds it has, is Yiskadel. Everyone who said Kaddish up until the Mishnah Berurah said Yiskadal, and that's the minhag. The Mishnah Berurah says it should be Yiskadel. This goes back, I think, to Satanov and Moskiel. Be that as it may, the fact why you hear people say Yiskadel is because the Mishnah Berurah says you should say Yiskadel. So the Mishnah Berurah is very influential. Yeah, when we use the Chayyadim also, the Kitzer, I don't know, I mean, Kitzer is very popular, but today I don't know who uses it. Chayyadim, you're saying, the Sephardim post Mishnah Berurah with the Chaf HaChaim's notes, not only that, the Rav Mazuz, in Bnei Brak, Kisei Rachamim has the Mishnah Berurah with the Sephardic halachot, not necessarily Chaf HaChaim, just the Sardic halachot from Tunisia and the like, because today it's such a popular sefer, everyone's learning it, so you need to publish it. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan, writing at the turn of the 20th century, records the halacha that when you have a girl, you do not say the blessing Hatova Meiti. There is a blessing that you thank God for good things, positive things. And when you have a boy, you make this blessing. You can make this blessing and other things also, but that's when you make it. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan says you don't make this blessing when you have a girl, because the happiness of having a girl is not the same happiness as having a boy. It's not the same supreme happiness. When you have a boy, you're much happier than when you have a girl. That's what the Aruch HaShulchan says. Mark, the Alkot Yosef is Rav Avad Yosef's sons. It's a modern code, some 30 volumes in which he takes all of Rav Avad Yosef's psukim and puts them throughout the entire, every Archaim, Yoredeh, etc. And that's become the new code, really, for the Sephardic world. If you have a question, you don't want to know halachas, you don't look in the Shulchan Aruch. You look in the Yalkut Yosef. And if you're an Ashkenazi, you look in the Yalkut Yosef also, because it has great notes giving all the sources. But that's become their halacha l'maisa book. Thank you, Dov. After 30 days, okay, so I was Mechavein to Yechavadas when it comes to Mechai HaMesim. At least I was right on one thing. And Shechayanu, he says, even if you've heard on the telephone. Okay, thank you, Dov. So here we have the Aruch HaShulchan reflecting the value system, obviously, of himself, but also of a great deal of the Jewish community this time. And it's very ironic. Next class, we will speak about Rav Nissim's relationship with the most learned woman Torah scholar in a few hundred years. So it's really interesting, this approach to women. But it's hardly news that girls were not greeted with the same sort of joy that boys were. And for some people, it was a bad thing to have a girl, like it is in maybe in China or places like that. Solomon Maimon, in his autobiography, speaks about what happened to this chassid when he was visiting one Hasidic town, because when he announced that he had a girl, and the people, the way they abused him for having a girl. Now, the Talmud, in discussing the blessing at Tov Le'Ametiv, says nothing about this. The Talmud simply says that at the birth of a boy, one says this blessing. It's possible to simply see this as an example of what brings happiness. Not saying that dafka, precisely you say it when you have a boy, but that, no, the Talmud is giving an example of what brings happiness. You know, just giving an example. When you, if you have a boy, you say it. And Maimonides records it in Hilchot Brachot, quote, whatever is good for oneself and others, you say it to them 18. So you win the lottery, you can say it to them 18. So, if you feel happiness when you have a girl, as we all do, you say it to them 18. You see, according to the Rambam, this is a great example of where our subjective feelings of equal happiness should lead to a different halacha. And just like the Munkacher, in meeting the Saba Kadisha, used his own personal feelings to understand the halacha, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, based upon the Rambam, decides, halacha l'maisa, that today you should make the bracha atav le'ametiv when you have a girl. Now, this is actually a rejection of the Shulchan Aruch's position as well, because it's the Shulchan Aruch that reads it restrictively, unlike the Rambam. And Rav Nachum Rabinovich doesn't make it a practice to reject the Shulchan Aruch and decide in accordance with Maimonides. But in this case, he thought that this was more in line with the way people feel, and he doesn't say that that this is what the Shulchan Aruch meant, because the Shulchan Aruch is pretty clear, it's when you have a boy. Uh-huh, okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that Beis Yosef. Thank you, Jonathan. Now, towards the end of Rav Uziel's life, we spoke about Rav Uziel, we had two or three classes on him. He approaches Rav Nissim and tells him that he wants Rav Nissim to be his successor. This was going to be quite unusual because Rav Nissim had never before held a rabbinic post. And it was also going to be a legal issue because according to the rules of the chief rabbinate, the only person permitted to become chief rabbi is one who is currently serving as a rav. Why did he come to Rav Nissim? Because although Rav Nissim was working for a living, he was regarded as really the leader in the land of Israel of the Iraqi Torah community. He was a great Torah scholar. He was the posek for the community. He was an outstanding figure. The fact that he worked for a living, it's only that today we have this screwed up mentality that you have places, you have schools in Lakewood and the like, in which if you actually work for a living, they don't want your kids. We become so screwed up that the idea of working for a living and being Torah scholar, they're automatically opposed. No, Rav Nissim was a great Torah scholar, and he was working. But he was reluctant. He didn't want to assume the position. Yet many people encouraged him. Rav Herzog, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Maimon, Rav Yehuda Leib Maimon, the leading Mizrahi figure, who knew Rav Nissim from Baghdad. Rav Maimon did Zionist work. He traveled to Baghdad, and when he met Rav Nissim, they became the closest of friends, because here he's traveling all over the world, and he finds Rav Nissim. Not only does Rav Nissim have a great library of all the various Sephardic works, he has all the great Ashkenazic works as well. And if you know Rav Maimon, Rav Maimon also had one of the great Jewish libraries of the 20th century, which then went to Mossad and Rav Kook, a great bibliophile. And when I say, you know, we speak about Jack Lunzer, who certainly probably has the greatest private collection in our time. He's asking $40 million for it. But as far as I know, Jack Lunzer is not a London. I never met him. When I was last year in London for Shavuos, Scholar in Residence, I was at the St. John's Wood Synagogue, and I didn't really know the name. I just knew the name Jack Lunzer, but I didn't know him personally. And I'm with his former son-in-law, who happens to still be close to him. And he's telling me, you got to come over to my former father-in-law's house. I have to show you his book collection. No, I didn't know about this book collection. I said, okay, next time I'm in London, I'll come. Of course, there'll never again be a book collection like this in private hands. And I blew my chance. I was busy last Wednesday in New York. I had meetings, and I couldn't go see the collection. And I didn't get a chance to go when I was in London. But from what I know about Jack Lunzer, he's a wonderful collector, but I don't think he's a Lamden. Rav Nissim and Rav Maimon, who also had huge collections, they actually read every book they had. And they could tell you every page in every one of these books what's there. They were great scholars as well. So there's a difference between a collector and a scholar. I see it's already 10, and we've just really just begun. We will get into really into the meat of Rav Nissim next class, his election chief rabbinate, his halachic positions, the controversy that shook the world, that we had repercussions of this last month when the chief rabbi of Israel took on the Pope and refused to bend and said that we don't care for His Excellency, Jewish pride is more important. We'll do this all next week. Yeah, it's actually not an article, Mark. I'll send it to you. It's a friend of mine has a long comment on one of these blogs. I will say, email me and I'll send it to you. I can still find it. I'll send it to you. Do we have more of his letters with Ashkenazi rabbis? Well, there are many letters. You have to go to Yad Harav Nissim. I was there last summer and I went through his entire archives. Published, we do not have, other than in the Yom HaTov. In here we have letters of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, or many from Ratzi Pesach Frank, and others. These are halachic. So I'll speak about some of them next class. Stuff from the Chafetz Chaim. I didn't see anything from the Chafetz Chaim other than when I was looking through it. This is the sort of thing that a lot of these letters end up in other hands. But Yad Harav Nissim has a huge collection, and I will speak next class about the correspondence of Rav Nissim and Rav David Lifshitz, because it becomes relevant to something we're going to be doing. This was actually published in this book, Zevet HaTov. I'll speak about this book next class. I have to thank my father for getting it for me. It's the Jubilee volume in honor of Rabbi Zevulun Charlap. It was given out at the Yeshiva University dinner this year, which my father attended. But I'll speak about this next class. Okay, so if we don't have any more questions, we meet next week, and in the week after that we don't meet. It's Purim, and we'll pick up, we'll have then three more classes after Purim. Take us very close to Pesach. Okay, everyone, thank you again. Thank you. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.